VentureCast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome to episode 135 of the Burden of Command podcast. This podcast is a production of the Leadership Phalanx, and you can find out more about me and what we do at leadershipphalanx.com. That's leadership, PHALANX.com. I'm your host, Earl Breon, and today's guest comes to us from our friends over at Interview Valet, and his name is Dr. Trevor Blattner. Trevor is a podcast host, author of the book Redefining the Top 1%, and a leading thinker on shepherd leadership, a modern approach to leadership designed to encourage traits that guide, support, and uplift. With over 20 years of research and coaching, Dr. Blattner has developed a model of leadership that breaks free of the antiquated and regressive notions of what it means to lead. His enlightened approach to leadership is based on behavioral science, personal experience, and a strong commitment to personal values. Now, as you can see just from that intro alone, Trevor and I have a lot in common, and we have an outstanding conversation coming up here that I'm not going to keep you from any further. So I'm going to shut up, get out of the way, let that stinger play, and let you get into this outstanding interview with Dr. Trevor Blattner. Trevor, thanks for being with us.
Earl, thanks for having me. It's always great to be on a new show, and your show is particularly interesting. I love the title, and I love the other episodes I've listened to already, so I'm excited to be a part of it.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It means a lot coming from a fellow podcaster, and we'll talk about that here, because I want to give you a chance to pub your podcast, and we're going to talk about your book, Redefining the Top 1%. I really appreciate that. And speaking of the title, let's get you started where I start everybody. What is your version when you hear the phrase burden of command? What does that mean to you?
Yeah, it's a great question. The phrase, you know, it's a bit intimidating to think about, because it does sound, to me, it brings about the feeling of responsibility, particularly, in terms of a privilege, really, that we have as leaders to influence those that we come into contact with. So I think it's really the responsibility and privilege to influence is what the burden of command means to me. But also, which is very much related to the book that I wrote recently, Redefining the Top 1%, is that privilege, it's not a right. It can be lost based on our own individual performance as leaders. And so if we're not holding up our end of the bargain, that privilege to influence others, hopefully in a positive way, can be lost. So I think that's part of the burden of command as well.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love that last piece there too about it's not a right. I mean, because I think that's something that a lot of folks struggle with. Especially when you start talking about, like, say, generational companies.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, that they feel like just because that they are the son of the previous person who everybody loved, that they have the right to lead. And you got to earn that every day, right?
Yeah, you do. And the name, it's kind of that cliche in sports. It's not about the name on the back of the jersey. It's about the name on the front of the jersey. And, in many ways, that's true in leadership, too. I mean, if just because you're the next in line generationally and you have the same last name as the previous CEO or owner, has nothing to do with how successful or effective you're going to be as the leader of the company. And so I think that's a great point you bring up.
Yeah, no, I love it. So, OK, let's talk about redefining the top 1% here. Just a second, because You know, 1% is one of those phrases that, you know, has been very popular, was more popular a few years ago. We had the, you know, the Occupy 1% and all that good stuff going on. And so that, that term has had a lot of negativity, attached to it. So why, so is that one of the reasons why you want to quote redefine the top 1%?
It is. I mean, it is one of the reasons. And, you know, there's a few different ways to sort of explain the idea. And one is, you know, I am a hyper competitive person. And so I think a lot of people that are, you know, maybe in leadership roles or have had a limited amount of success in life, they have that kind of competitive edge, about them. And, you know, so to me, the top 1% in and of itself is somewhat of an attractive, idea in that we always want to be striving for that. But I do think that the term has gotten a very negative, connotation over time and understandably so, you know. And so the idea is not really that, you know, we want to strive to be in the 1% in an exclusive way. But what we want to do is redefine what for us each individually is the very top 1% of our own contribution and ability. And so how can we look at, you know, particularly there were some statistics that I came upon as I was doing the research for this book, which really was prompted by, you know, the COVID-19 outbreak early 2020 is when kind of the writing ramped up for the book. And so when I was doing the research there, you know, it came up statistically, there are a lot of, you know, a lot of challenges we as Americans and globally have from a mental health standpoint, you know, just from a socioeconomic standpoint as well. And I'm just going to throw a couple of those out as far as, you know, so the listeners can get an idea of my thought process as I was writing the book. One of them is that the use of antidepressants by Americans specifically is up 400% over the last 30 years, which I thought is a pretty remarkable stat. You know, just saying that we as Americans, being a pretty hyper achievement oriented culture in general, we're still struggling a lot with our own anxiety and our own insecurity and mental health challenges. And that was alarming to me. Another thing that really probably even more so was an article I read in the Washington Post by a guy named Rich Lowry. And he wrote about the life expectancy, particularly between the ages of 25 and 65. For the first time in several generations, is actually decreasing. And so people in that kind of sweet spot in life where you should be thriving, 25 to 65, people are dying much earlier than previous generations. And a lot of those deaths are either self-inflicted or, you know, related to addiction or things that are not natural causes. And so, you know, all those things together, you know, in his article, he rounds it out by saying American adulthood has suddenly become more lethal than it has been in decades. And it's defined by more, by less procreation and more self-destruction. And so, it's kind of that dichotomy of, you know, we've got the side of really pushing toward being the very best we can be. But also the side of really just struggling to survive and balancing the two things. And so that's kind of where the title of redefining the top 1% came from. And the idea of the book is really, you know, what are the, I'm a research oriented person, you know, and so I did my residency and wrote a thesis and been published in peer reviewed journals and all that. And so that's kind of the way my brain works. And so what I tried to do was build, you know, a set of behaviors that people can kind of put into their lives that are based on sound research and also aren't, you know, aren't just theoretical. They can actually be put into practice.
Well, no, I like that. And, you know, as you're as you're sharing those statistics, you know, it's you're coming on the heels of so we're recording today on August 12th. The Census Bureau has been talking about getting ready to put out new data that shows that for the first time in history, the white demographic is shrinking. And the quote unquote minority demographics are increasing, and a lot of these things that you're talking about, right, is quote successful white people are you use the clinical term procreating less. Right. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is hearing you say those statistics and the Census Bureau thing coming out. It reminds me, and I know some of my listeners because I got a lot of veteran listeners here, and this is the kind of humor that we gravitate towards. And I don't know if you've ever heard of this movie or not, but Idiocracy.
I have heard of it. I have not seen it, though.
So it's interesting because it's widely panned as the first movie that was filmed as a comedy that has become a documentary.
Interesting. Because
this is the premise of it, right? Is like at the very beginning, they go through this whole thing where people stop having kids because they're more worried about their careers. And because in the movie, the way they term it, the less intelligent are still procreating, the kind of the IQ is going down and society takes this shift, right? Now, I don't think we're quite there yet because we're making great advancements right now. But I guess but the point
it's an interesting premise, though. Isn't it
is
that you could see where it could happen.
Yeah, it definitely is. And they even had a I'll just say they even had a Hollywood president in the movie. So there you go. But again, kind of circling back here, like it is. It's very interesting to see, you know, that some of this stuff is actually happening. Right. I don't want to get distracted by the movie part here. But it's interesting to see these statistics coming out that this is actually happening. And you mentioned these kind of seven behaviors. Let's talk about a few of those. What are some of those seven?
Yeah. So, you know, I sort of laid the book out in a visual. There's a visual at the beginning that sort of shows a stair step in a triangle sort of that puts all the behaviors together. But the idea is that each behavior precedes the one before it, and then the next one builds from there. And so, I'll just kind of walk you through the behaviors, what they're called. So, behavior one is embrace radical responsibility, which is very difficult to argue with. I think anyone that's a successful leader understands that taking responsibility is kind of foundational, you know, to success. And then number two is recognize and optimize your higher self. Number three is choose leadership and manage ego. It was originally titled Refuse Ego, but then that's not really realistic. So we changed the title to Manage Ego because we all deal with it in different ways. Number four is strategically design your reality. And actually that chapter talks quite a bit about quantum physics and you know, goal setting and how the two work together. And then behavior five is commit to mastery. Six is relentlessly invest in the big three. And then number seven is the final one, which really ties all of them together. And it's about having faith in something that's larger than oneself. And that one's called Be Still and Know. And so just those are the seven behaviors, and they all sort of you know, build on one another. We can kind of talk about any of them in whichever order you'd like. But I mean, I do think, you know, addressing number one is important because it sort of sets the tone for everything else. And I do think that it is a challenge. You know, even, you know, for me personally, certainly when you write a book like this, you know, there is an ideal that you're setting forth, you know, and there's an ideal version of each of us that we strive to be. And that ideal version would be the version that adopts each of these behaviors at the very highest level at all times, both, you know, in front of people and behind closed doors. And I think that you know, Jocko Willink and some of the other Navy SEAL types have written books about this idea of responsibility. And I think those ideas resonate so well because we all know it's true that without that foundational element of saying, you know, the buck really stops here, and even things that are quote unquote outside of my immediate control still fall under my responsibility if they're happening within my organization or my family or my team. And, you know, I think until a leader is able to sort of embrace that idea, it's hard to really build any other behaviors that are effective on top of it. And so there are different exercises that we go through. There's actually 35 different like exercise related activities throughout the book to kind of integrate these behaviors into our lives and just try to be more effective daily. So, I can go through a few of those as well. But one of the things I think that I would want to mention also that has to do with this first behavior, and really all of them, is just the idea of self-awareness. That is not really, you know, we don't really have education on that. And, you know, things like emotional intelligence and, self-awareness, you know, being really aware of our own strengths, but also our own inherent weaknesses that we may or may not be aware of, and are oftentimes unconscious. You know, they fall into the realm of something we're not consciously aware of, but others are. And I think as a leader, it is within our realm of responsibility to try to get a hold on those things. And that's something I've learned the hard way. And I would think that almost anyone in a leadership role of any kind, whether it's as a parent or a coach or a CEO, has probably had that challenge at one time or another.
Yeah. No, I love it. And I think you're right. And, you know, again, Jocko, I love Jocko. The thing being a Marine, those are some of the same principles, you know, that we mm-hmm. were taught, kind of the foundation. And what I like about your behaviors is you're going through those and you have them laid out in the, basically chapter by chapter. What's interesting is, and I don't know if you've done any work with military folks or not, but it lines mm-hmm. up very nicely with what we call the 11 leadership principles. Mm-hmm. I've adapted them here at the Leadership Phalanx to call them Shields of the Phalanx. But, you know, one of those is seek responsibility and take responsibility for your actions. Mm-hmm. And those can be traced all the way back 2,600 years to Sun Tzu. So we know that if you got something that lasts 2,700 years, there's probably some validity to that, right?
It's tried and true, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No doubt.
And what I love about this, because let me ask you, like, especially when you're talking about number one, because I know Jocko's ran into it. I've ran into it quite a bit.
Sure.
A lot of people read this one principle here, this one behavior, embrace radical responsibility. Mm-hmm. And they translate that into everything's my fault. Everything's my fault. Everything's my fault. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Everything's my fault. And it's not what you're trying to say, right?
Definitely not. No. And I think that there's a subtle shift there in that, you know, it's, first of all, I think it's not really about blame, you mm-hmm. know, it's not really about saying, you know, obviously this particular situation didn't go the way we would have drawn it up, but, and that may be due to a number of different reasons. It's usually not one thing that happened or one individual, that is, you know, quote unquote, fault is related to the problem. But I would say that focusing on who's to blame, you know, whether it's yourself as the leader or another individual, is not as important as realizing that finding a way to a solution, you know, and being solution oriented rather than problem focused is the key, you know. And I think part of taking responsibility has to do with the way we think, you know, and taking responsibility for the type of a thinker and the type of a an energy that we bring to the organization and the team. And I think that that energy needs to be solution oriented rather than problem oriented. And I think that's really more important than that idea of saying, well, you know, if something goes wrong, it's my fault because I'm the leader. You know, I'm to blame. And so I think that distinction is important to make, because really at the end of the day, does it matter who, you know, who's to blame? And the answer really is no. It's just the important thing is, what do we do to move forward in an effective way?
And you just hit the nail right on the head with that last comment there. You know, it's crazy to think that it's a little over 2 years ago now, but back in episode 5 of this podcast, I relayed the story of Apollo 1, and I don't know if you ever heard this speech or not before, but it's called the Kranz Dictum.
I don't know that I have.
Yeah, so for those listeners who aren't familiar, you know, Apollo 1, in the lead up to it, is when they had the big fire that killed the 3 astronauts.
Yes.
And they had an investigation coming. Well, Gene Kranz, you know, way before Apollo 13, he was the big dog there, right?
Right.
And before they even had a chance to call for an investigation, Monday morning, because this happened on a Friday, Monday morning, he gathers his team and he basically says, I don't care what the investigations find. We were at fault. And he lays out a list of things that they did. You know, we got complacent. We didn't, we let our checks slip. We didn't do any of the things that we knew that we were supposed to do. And that led to this death. We're all responsible.
Mm.
He didn't say you're responsible. He didn't say I'm responsible.
Yeah.
We are responsible. And that last piece that you gave there, I think, was the critical piece. He made everybody there go back to their office, and on the chalkboard, he made them write the words tough and competent.
Mm.
And that was the two words that they had to live by was, you know, we're going to be tough. We're going to stand up. When we see something wrong, we're going to have the fortitude to stand up right in there. I don't care if you're the first person here and you're talking to Gene Kranz, you better say something. And everybody better come through the door with a competency to be able to identify their job and what's going wrong.
Mm.
And it was solutions, which you just talked about. It gave them a clear solution on how to go forward. And their record improved. And they went straight and, you know, we got to the moon finally.
Isn't that amazing?
It is, right? Because, you know, think about that for a second. Like, and this is the one thing I always like to point out, because I hope you can hear that you've struck a chord with me here, because I love this. Oh,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, it's so important. Yeah.
Well, you know, think about that for a second, right? Most Americans know Gene Kranz through the Apollo 13 disaster. Mm. And those men made it home in large part due to his leadership.
Right.
If he doesn't handle the Apollo 1 disaster the way he does, he's fired. He's gone.
He's not even around for that.
Mm-hmm. And who knows how Apollo 13 turns out if we even get there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and really it was just somewhat of a subtle shift in his mentality and the mentality that he wanted everyone else on the team to have, which was, you know, we have to look at every scenario, you know, we have to be tough enough to face the reality of it. And then we have to be confident in the level of competence we each have in our own role. And it's kind of, you know, it's kind of simple, not always easy, but a simple concept of like these two things are our focus, toughness and competency.
Well, and I think that falls in line like with some of these other behaviors here, which is, again, why I like it. So, I mean, what he did was strategically designed his reality, right?
He did. Yeah. Yeah. and absolutely. And the other one would be commit to mastery, you know, in terms of competence, you know, demanding that each individual take personal responsibility for their role, you know, and the expertise that they have. And raise the level of that expertise to the point where there is no doubt that they have the ability to solve the problem they're responsible for solving. And in this book, Commit to Mastery is a lot. There's a lot of research that we go through related to what it actually takes to become an expert, you know, in a chosen field. People have probably heard about Anders Ericsson. or Malcolm Gladwell with the kind of the 10,000 hours rule, and he adapted some of the concepts from Erickson into his book Outliers. But that's really it's somewhat of an oversimplified version of what Erickson's research has to say about, you know, how do you practice and what does it look like to become really, really excellent at your given field of expertise. And so I think that's very much in line with Kranz's idea of competency and figuring out a way to up level that on a daily basis.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, and I like the way, you know, I like the way you put that, to commit to mastery, and it's, it's okay to do that. Right. I mean, like some people get told, hey, you don't want to get obsessed. You don't want to get to the point where it's unhealthy, right? You don't want to be
losing. Certainly a fine line. Yeah,
exactly. I mean,
absolutely. And this is one where, you know, you'll ask, you know, 10 people and get sort of 10 different opinions on how to go about this in someone's life. So, I was listening to an audiobook recently. You've probably heard of Tim Grover, or maybe familiar with. He was the athletic trainer, kind of the mental toughness coach for Michael Jordan.
Okay.
He had a 15-year run with Michael when the Bulls were winning their championships. And then when Michael retired, then he started coaching one-on-one with Kobe Bryant and then Dwayne Wade. And so he's written a couple of books. One is called Relentless. And then the other most recent one is called Winning. And it's just the idea of like, you know, what does it take to be that kind of a performer, you know, and to have the really the mental state of somebody that's the best in the world, you know, in terms of competition. And, you know, his approach is really, you know, pretty intense in terms of finding balance in life can be very challenging for someone like that. And for him, he finds that to be okay, you know, to accept that balance is somewhat unattainable. And I think that is a fine line because there are times in life where we are so committed to something that we can get, you know, out of balance and some of the other important things in our life can be put on the back burner, either intentionally or unintentionally. And I do think that that is something to be aware of as a leader, particularly as a type A achievement-oriented type of person. This is where self-awareness comes in again, is know yourself well enough to know if, you know, your tendencies and when you can get off track or maybe overcommit. Because I know personally, that's something that I've been guilty of, you know, at many different times along the way. And I think it's just something about being aware of it and addressing it as you go. And it's all a learning experience.
Yeah, I agree completely. And what I love, again, you lined right up with those principles of Marine Corps leadership is one of is know yourself and seek self-improvement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and go with another sports figure. And I can never remember who it was that said this, but back when Tiger Woods was first going through, you know, his ordeals with his marriage,
sure.
Somebody, and then like, you know, he had the ordeal with his marriage and then immediately his golf game dropped up, you know, For the folks who don't remember, there was a time where if Tiger Woods showed up wearing red on Sunday, game was over.
It was over. Everybody was going home. That's right.
But they made this connection here that I think is kind of important to this here with what we're talking about is, immediately after the incident where his wife threw the golf club through the window, His golf game dropped. They said, look, this is a guy who spent his entire life being number one, everybody telling him he was number one, and that he could do anything he wanted to. And somebody actually stood up to him and said, that's not true anymore. And it kind of wrecked his world.
It sure did, man. Almost a tragic thing to watch, you know, and on all sides, you know, because I remember it. I mean, I grew up with Tiger sort of, he was rising, you know, as I was growing up, and he had that several years in a row there where he was just unstoppable, and didn't look like he was ever going to to be stopped until he decided to retire. And you're right. It's like overnight, his entire psyche was flipped upside down. And, it shows you how important the mental side of, you know, certainly in athletics, but I think in anything where you're trying to perform at a high level, the mental side of it is so crucial because it can either make you or wreck you like it did in his life. And he really never has gotten back since then.
Well, and I think that ties into your behavior number three there, the choose leadership and manage ego, you know, kind of tying that in with commit to mastery. You kind of, those two, and again, this is why I'm really vibing with what you've got going on here with this redefining the top 1%, because, you know, everything works together. Like you said,
it does.
You can do one, you can do two, but it really works better when you do all seven, right?
It does. And I mean, I think, and they really, you know, contribute to one another and they feed off of each other. And, you know, as I said, like it, in many ways, as I was writing the book, it was very intimidating to me personally and still is that, you know, to do all of these things well all the time is not easy. I mean, it's anything but easy, but it's really more of a, it's kind of a North Star, you know, that you want to set for yourself to try to be, you know, the very best version of yourself you can be, so that you can sort of represent the standard for those that are, you know, that are looking to you for leadership. And so, you know, it's interesting, the behavior number three, choose leadership and manage ego. I looked quite a bit into, you know, what managing ego looks like and what, like, does humility have anything to do with leadership from an effectiveness standpoint in terms of research? Like, is there anything that the literature says about humility? And there actually, I actually did find, quite a bit about that, and how truly humble leaders are more effective. And there are a few different things that I found. One is that, humble leaders prioritize organizational success over their own success, which boosts the success of the organization over time. Companies with humble CEOs have less turnover and higher employee satisfaction, which is important. Also, humble leaders admit mistakes and recognize their own limitations, which increases morale within the organization. And followers of humble leaders are more motivated and work harder because they know the leader is counting on them to step up. So those are just a few things that are borne out in the scientific literature, the psychological literature, to sort of support the idea that, you know, command and control and ego-driven alpha-style leadership is really not proven to be more effective than a leader that has the awareness of their own shortcomings and are willing to sort of, you know, admit those and address them. So,
yeah, well, exactly. You know, and I mean, we, it's kind of interesting, right? Because the folks who don't necessarily manage their ego, are the ones that really get the limelight because they're out there pushing it.
Oh, sure.
You know,
it's exciting, you know, it's interesting to watch someone like that. Yeah,
it is, but it's like you said, it's the folks that people really want to work for that, you know, probably going to be some names that most people have never heard before.
Very likely. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
but, but extremely effective within the organization, within the team.
Yeah. Like, I hate to keep coming back to sports here, but, you know, two of my favorite coaches of all time, I think, kind of fit into that category, and it's Joe Gibbs and Tony Dungy.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Both very soft-spoken, you know, in a public setting. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. And both gentlemen who have been through stuff, like, you know, Tony Dungy's story with his son committing suicide and things like that. Like, he's, yeah.
That was always unbelievable to me how well he was able to handle all of that, you know, and be so graceful and humble through all that and still, you know, maintain his effectiveness along the way, you know, incredible to watch.
It really is. It really is. And I think that's the key, right? I mean, because it keeps, you know, it keeps everybody kind of on that level. You know, especially with the things we're going through right now, you know, and we're hopefully coming through the end of this COVID thing here. I know,
man, God willing, I hope so too.
But you know, we're seeing this right now, right? The companies with the leaders who were able to do the things we've been talking about here, they've not only survived, but in a lot of ways they've thrived. And the companies haven't, well, we're seeing a lot of issues now, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we really are, and I think, you know, generationally, this does make a difference too. You know, and I know, you know, a lot's been written about millennials and then now Gen Z, and not all of it's been positive. You know, the things that have been been discussed and written, and those generations are going to shape our country, and those generations want to work with and for people that they know care about them, you know. Yeah. And I think that that's a big part of this this idea of redefining the top 1%. Also, is in the beginning of the book, I talk about you know what's the definition of success, and there's, you know, everyone's got their own definition, but the one that I try to have people at least entertain the idea of a definition is how much good can you do for others along the way? You know, how much good can be done by you for others? And I think the more you can do that, whether it's monetarily or, you know, one-on-one or whatever fashion through your business, that to me is a very good definition of how successful a person is. And I think one of the best ways to do that is to, you know, for the people in your organization, on your team, to know how much you actually care about them as human beings. And that matters a lot, particularly to the up and coming parts of the workforce.
Well, 100%, you know, and I think that's the big thing that we're starting to see right now, as we're, you know, some organizations are reintegrating, as they're calling it, and mm-hmm. Rehiring folks because they had to let them go during the pandemic, especially like fast food services and yeah. things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting when we see these numbers come out about how, or the kind of the mantra, well, you know, we can't find people that want to work anymore.
Yeah, we're hearing personally, that a lot. Yeah, we are.
And you know, I mean, man, maybe you mm-hmm. disagree, and that's fine. But for me, I think that misses the point, right? It's not that people don't want to work anymore. It's that people don't want to work in that environment anymore.
Well, you know, I think that's worth considering, you know, because, you know, there's a piece of it is, does it make sense for them financially to work or not? And that is a whole different discussion. And I think it's a short-sighted one because it's not going to be long-term. You know, mm-hmm. that's a short-term thing. But long-term, the discussion is, just like you said, what is the motivation to work somewhere that is a miserable situation for them? You know,
right.
I mean, why would they want to pour their heart and soul and sweat and blood into something that is, you know, unfulfilling, uncomfortable, and they don't feel cared for, you know, or cared about? And so I totally agree, you know, and you know, fast food industry, anything, any sort of industry used to the status quo, will have to, I think, regroup somewhat in terms of, the way that employees and team members are dealt with and, you know, sort of be able to pivot in a way that allows for more personal, engagement and interaction, among team members.
Yeah, sounds like they got to redefine the top 1%, right?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, and that's a. I mean, I think that's a good point that you bring up. It is because, I mean, you know, I don't know if you were a 16, 17, 18 year old kid, would you be really fired up to dive into a situation like that, the way that it is now? And I don't know that I would. So I think it's worth a conversation. It's worth thinking about. 100%.
Well, and just kind of let me add a layer of clarification for my perspective on it here. Mm-hmm. And because I don't want listeners to hear this and just think, oh, he's talking about evil McDonald's or he's talking about evil Hardee's.
I'm talking about customers too. You know, some of the stories have been coming out. Look, I'm from a small town in Northeast Tennessee. And, you know, I just heard a story, and this is something I would have never fathomed growing up in small town hospitality. Everybody says hi, hello, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, all that good stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Of a customer coming in, and like the kid, I don't even remember. It was like they put pepperoni on the pizza by accident. Like they gave them something extra, right? And a person comes in and just like throws the pizza behind the counter and starts yelling and screaming. So you can sit there and point fingers, you know, yeah, maybe McDonald's should pay people better. Maybe, you know, this should happen. But you as a customer too should treat these people better as well, right?
Mm. Well, I mean, absolutely. And it's interesting. I'm a people watcher sometimes. You know, I always find it fascinating when people will treat the waiter, for example, in that way, or you know, the ownership of the particular establishment in that way, and then expect great treatment on the opposite end. You know, expect to be treated well. And to me, that just it doesn't make sense that would be expected. So, it certainly goes for both sides of the engagement in, you know, whether you're on the service end or whether you're giving the service.
No, I love it. I love it. So, you know, again, listeners, we've been chatting here with Trevor Blattner, author of Redefining the Top 1%. But being an author isn't the only skill you have, right? You got your own podcast, right?
I do have a podcast. Yeah. It's also called Redefining the Top 1%. And it's been a lot of fun. I'm sure you can attest to the interesting, you know, people you get to meet when you run a podcast. I've been able to interview Seth Godin on the show, which was a pretty cool thing. Yeah. He's an author that I respect a lot. A number of sports psychologists. Let's see who else that people might know. Marshall Goldsmith, who's a big leadership author. Ben Newman, who's kind of a big social media influencer. So those conversations have been really, really neat. And then, of course, have been able to talk with lots of business owners as well to try to get just the most up-to-date, action-oriented tips on what works, in the world of high performance and leadership. And so that is the podcast. It's fun. Also, incidentally, I don't know if people even know this about me, but I am an endodontist also. So if people don't know what that is, that's a root canal specialist. If they've never been to one, they probably don't know they've probably never heard the term. But that's also a part of my, you know, leadership journey is that practice and the people on my team there, that is a big part of my life as well. So,
no, love it. I was introduced to my first endodontist just a few years ago.
Oh, so you know what I'm talking about then.
I do. And I can tell you right now, my experience was beautiful. I had a good. Great experience. I felt nothing. Mm-hmm. And the gentleman, it was a Dr. Lee. He made me feel at ease, and I went in there scared, like most people do when they come see
almost
you.
Almost everyone is scared to death when they walk in the door. Absolutely, yeah.
And he told me, he says, "If you feel anything, I haven't done my job right. Let me know."
That's right. That's right. And
I was like, he said, "It doesn't have
to be." That's the name of the game.
Pain. Mm-hmm. He said, "If you feel anything, I haven't done my job right." Mm-hmm. And it put me at ease real quick. So, yeah, endodontist, that's another one of those professions I think gets an unnecessary bad rap. So thank you for doing that job.
Well, thank you for saying that. I'm glad you had a good experience, too. I need to shout out to Dr. Lee. Is he in Indianapolis also?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Yeah. It's a small community, so I'll have to check him out.
Yeah. Yeah, he was, I haven't been back to him, thank goodness, mm-hmm. but good, even though it was a good experience, I don't want to rack up root canals,
Well, I don't blame you in that. So. And they're not overly inexpensive either. It's not something you want to do a whole lot if you don't have to.
That is correct. That was the only problem I had with Dr. Lee.
That's right.
So I'll get the link for your podcast in here too, because I definitely want folks to go check that out, because you've had some great guests on there. I just love what you're doing. Keep at it.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. It was a great conversation. I loved the commonality, I think, in philosophy and the Marine Corps principles are very much in line, I think, with which I'm happy to hear with a lot of the ideas in the book.
Oh yeah, no, and that's what I love, right? When I see a new book and I see these things, and when I see, you know, kind of disparate groups come together with the same ideas, that says, hey, yeah, we're on the right track here. So that's good.
Then these things are working, and they have been working for many, many years.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Before we work on closing out here, we've been chatting here for going on 45 minutes now, and it has just been a hoot. I've loved every second of it. But is there anything that we didn't get a chance to discuss that you'd like to leave listeners with?
You know, there's really not. No, I love the conversation, and I think I think it's been great. And if people are able to check the book out, there is a bonus. If people buy the book on our website, they will actually get the audiobook version and the PDF workbook that goes with the book for free. So if they go to drtrevorblotner.com/book-bonus, or just go to the website and find it at drtrevorblotner.com. They can do that and order and put their little order information in, and they'll get the audiobook and the workbook for free.
Outstanding. Yeah, I'll make sure we get that link in there as well. Cool. Well, you've been a great evangelist for what you do. I know my listeners are sitting here. They're wanting to get the copy of the book. We got that covered. We know where to get it. We got them figured out how to get the podcast. But if they want to, like, say, bring you on, maybe bring you into their organization, or heck, maybe they need a root canal, how can they find you best?
Yeah. So just email me. My personal email is TB, just the letter TB, at drtrevorblotner.com, drtrevorblatner, .com.
Outstanding. So you got anything else in the works coming up, or?
Well, at the moment, I'm going to be starting a coaching program. I'm going to start it as kind of a one-on-one, mentoring, leadership related coaching program. That's going to be later this year. And then kind of piggybacking off of the book. Also doing quite a bit of investing related to real estate and that kind of thing. So always looking to build my network with anybody interested in that space as well.
Outstanding. Well, you'll have to let me know when you get that up and running, and I can get that information added into the show notes and updated for you as well.
Thank you. That sounds great. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, Trevor, thank you very much for being with me and my listeners. It has been an outstanding discussion. I really thank you for your time.
Earl, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And, the pleasure was mine.
Oh, well, you can't have it all. I'm going to take some of that pleasure because it was great.
thanks, man. Appreciate
listeners, thank you for being with us here. I know you got a lot out of this. Trevor has shared a lot of great info, and I highly encourage you to go pick up a copy of Redefining the Top 1%, 7 Behaviors That Drive Shepherd Leadership. We'll get those links in there so you can find them very easy. Also, get over there and show him the same courtesy that you do me. Rate, subscribe, review, and share the show. If you have any comments, questions, or concerns for me, you can reach out at burden.command@gmail.com. That's burden.command@gmail.com. And again, rating, subscribing, sharing, reviewing the show, it helps us both get these messages out here. And you can have my great guest, like Trevor, help him spread his message further by doing that. And I thank each and every one of you that has done it for taking that responsibility seriously. With that, appreciate you all, and I look forward to talking to you again in the next episode.
Are you a fan of classic cinema or a young person who wants to discover the best films of all time? Do these legendary movies still hold up?
On the Generation Film Podcast, two guys who grew up when movies dominated the culture share a great film with a panel of young movie lovers and see how it plays for today's generation.
We discuss changes in storytelling, styles, representation,
the making of each film, its initial reception, and how its meaning has changed over the years.
Join us as we explore cinema classics across generations on Generation Film.
Electricast. Today is working for me. Do you believe that for yourself? Hey, I'm Pastor Julie, and I want to empower you through encouragement, inviting you to my podcast, Big Truth Encouragement, where I unpack living a faith-filled life. I created my podcast for the ladies, but gentlemen, you'll gain something too. So I invite you to listen to Big Truth Encouragement on Electricast and any platform where you listen to your podcast. Electricast.